3. 6 adults and an infant in a hostile landscape. Their fire seems a small thing against the darkness falling. Above them and beyond them, the hills of the valley rise like walls, while closer in, wrapped in the darkness of the valley itself, the huge shapes of the tombs seem to creep closer like saurian apparitions from some antediluvian age. Braun Lamia is tired and aching and very irritable. The sound of Saul Weintraub's baby crying sets her teeth on edge. She knows the others are also tired. None has slept more than a few hours in the past 3 nights, and the day just ending has been filled with tension and unresolved terrors. She sets the last piece of wood on the fire.
"There's no more where that came from,"
snaps Martin Silenus. The fire lights the poet's satirish features from below.
"I know it," says Braun Lamia, too tired to put anger or any other energy into her voice. The firewood is from a cache carried in by the pilgrim groups of years gone by. Their 3 small tents are set in the area traditionally used by the pilgrims in their last night before confronting the shrike. They are camped close to the time tomb called the Sphinx, and the black sweep of what may be a wing blots out some of the sky.
"We'll use the lantern when this is gone," says the consul. The diplomat looks even more exhausted than the others. The flickering light casts a red tint over his sad features. He had dressed in diplomatic finery for the day, but now the cape and tricorn cap look as soiled and wilted as the consul himself. Colonel Cassad returns to the fire and slides the night visor up onto the top of his helmet. Cassad is wearing full combat gear, and the activated chameleon polymer shows only his face, floating 2 meters above the ground.
"Nothing," he says. "No movement, no heat traces, no sound besides the wind."
Cassad leans the Force multipurpose assault rifle against a rock and sits near the others, the fibers of his impact armor deactivating into a matte black, not much more visible than before.
"Do you think the shrike will come tonight?" asks Father Hoyt.
The priest has his black cloak wrapped around him and seems as much a part of the night as Colonel Cassad. The thin man's voice is strained. Cassad leans forward and pokes the fire with his baton.
"There is no way to tell. I'll stand watch just in case."
Suddenly, all 6 look up as the star-filled sky spasms with color, orange and red blossoms unfolding silently, obliterating the starfield.
"There hasn't been much of that in the past few hours," says Saul Weintraub, rocking his infant.
Rachel has quit crying and now tries to grasp her father's short beard. Weintraub kisses her tiny hand.
"They're testing hegemony defenses again," says Cassad.
Sparks rise from the prodded fire, embers floating into the sky as if seeking to join the brighter flames there.
"Who won?"
asks Lamia, referring to the silent space battle which had filled the sky with violence all the night before and much of that day.
"Who fucking cares?" says Martin Silenus.
He searches through the pockets of his fur coat as if he might find a full bottle there. He does not.
"Who fucking cares?"
he mutters again.
"I care," the consul says tiredly. "If the Ousters break through, they may destroy Hyperion before we find the shrike."
Silenus laughs derisively.
"Oh, that would be terrible, wouldn't it? To die before we discover death? To be killed before we are scheduled to be killed. To go out swiftly and without pain, rather than to writhe forever on the shrike's thorns. Oh, terrible thought, that!"
"Shut up," says Braun Lamia, and her voice again is without emotion, but this time is not devoid of threat. She looks at the consul.
"So where is the shrike? Why didn't we find it?"
The diplomat stares at the fire.
"I don't know. Why should I know?"
"Perhaps the shrike is gone," says Father Hoyt. "Perhaps by collapsing the anti-entropic fields, you've freed it forever. Perhaps it's carried its scourge elsewhere."
The consul shakes his head and says nothing.
"No,"
says Saul Weintraub. The baby is sleeping against his shoulder.
"It will be here. I feel it."
Braun Lamia nods.
So do I. It's waiting.
She had retrieved several ration units from her pack, and now she pulls heating tabs and passes the units around.
I know that anti-climax is the warp and woof of the world, says Silenus, but this is fucking ridiculous, all dressed up with nowhere to die.
Braun Lamia glowers but says nothing, and for a while they eat in silence. The flames fade from the sky, and the densely packed stars return. But embers continue to rise, as if seeking escape. Wrapped in the dreamy haze tumble of Braun Lamia's thoughts twice removed, I try to reassemble the events since last I dreamt their lives. The pilgrims had descended into the valley before dawn, singing, their shadows thrown before them by the light from the battle a billion kilometers above. All day they had explored the time tombs. Each minute they expected to die. After some hours, as the sun rose and the high desert cold gave way to heat, their fear and exultation faded. The long day was silent except for the rasp of sand, occasional shouts, and the constant, almost subliminal moan of the wind around rocks and tombs. Kassad and the consul each had brought an instrument that measured the intensity of the anti-entropic fields. But Lamia had been the first to notice that these were not needed, that the ebb and flow of the time tides could be felt as a slight nausea, overladen with a sense of déjà vu which did not fade. Nearest to the entrance of the valley had been the Sphinx. Then came the Jade Tomb, its walls translucent only in morning and evening twilight. Then, less than 100 meters farther in, rose the tomb called the Obelisk. The pilgrim path then led up the widening arroyo to the largest tomb of them all, centrally placed, the crystal monolith, its surface devoid of design or opening, its flat-topped roof flush with the tops of the valley walls. Then came the three cave tombs, their entrances visible only because of the well-worn paths that led to them. And finally, almost a kilometer farther down the valley, sat the so-called Shrike Palace. Its sharp flanges and outflung spires, reminiscent of the spikes of the creature said to haunt this valley. All day they had moved from tomb to tomb, none venturing off alone, the group pausing before entering those artifacts which might be entered. Saul Weintraub had been all but overcome with emotion upon seeing and entering the Sphinx, the same tomb where his daughter had contracted the Merlin sickness 26 years earlier. The instruments set out by her university team still sat on tripods outside the tomb, although none in the group could tell if they still functioned, carrying out their monitoring duties. The passageways in the Sphinx were as narrow and labyrinthine as Rachel's comlog entries had suggested. The strings of glow globes and electric lights left behind by various research groups now dark and depleted. They used hand torches and Kassad's night visor to explore the place. There was no sign of the room Rachel had been in when the walls closed in on her and the sickness began. There were only vestigial remnants of the once powerful time tides. There was no sign of the Shrike. Each tomb had offered its moment of terror, of hopeful and dreadful anticipation, only to be replaced by an hour or more of anti-climax as dusty, empty rooms appeared, just as they had to the tourists and Shrike pilgrims of centuries past. Eventually, the day had ended in disappointment and fatigue. The shadows from the eastern valley wall drawing across the tombs and valley like a curtain closing an unsuccessful play. The day's heat had vanished, and the high desert cold returned quickly, borne on a wind that smelled of snow and the high reaches of the Bridal Range, 20 kilometers to the southwest. Kassad suggested that they make camp. The consul had shown the way to the traditional grounds where Shrike pilgrims had waited their last night before meeting the creature they sought. The flat area near the Sphinx, showing traces of litter from research groups as well as pilgrims, pleased Saul Weintraub, who imagined his daughter had camped there. No one else objected. Now, in full darkness with the last piece of wood burning, I sensed the six of them drawing closer, not merely to the fire's warmth, but to each other.
drawn by the fragile but tangible cords of shared experience forged during their voyage upriver on the levitation barge Benares and in their crossing to Keep Kronos. More than that, I sensed a unity more palpable than emotional bonds. It took a moment, but I soon realized that the group was connected in a microsphere of shared data and sense web, on a world whose primitive regional data relays had been shredded by the first hint of combat. This group had linked comm logs and biomonitors to share information and to watch over one another as best they could. While the entry barriers were obvious and solid, I had no trouble sliding past, through, and under them, picking up the finite but numerous clues. Pulse, skin temperature, cortical wave activity, access request, data inventory, which allowed me some insight into what each pilgrim was thinking, feeling, and doing. Kassad, Hoyt, and Lamia had implants. The flow of their thoughts were easiest to sense. At that second, Braun Lamia was wondering if it had not been a mistake to seek out the Shrike. Something was nagging at her, just under the surface, but unrelenting in its demand to be heard. She felt as if she were ignoring some terribly important clue which held the solution to... what? Braun Lamia had always despised mysteries. It was one of the reasons she had left a life of some comfort and leisure to become a private investigator. But what mystery? She had all but solved the murder of her cybrid client and lover, and had come to Hyperion to fulfill his final wish. Yet she sensed that this nagging doubt had little to do with the Shrike. What? Lamia shook her head and poked the dying fire. Her body was strong, raised to resist Lussis's 1.3 standard gravity, and trained to even greater strength. But she had not slept in several days, and she was very, very tired. She became vaguely aware that someone was speaking.
"Just to take a shower and get some food," says Martin Silenus. "Perhaps use your comm unit and Fatline Link to see who's winning the war."
The consul shakes his head. "Not yet. The ship is for an emergency." Silenus gestures toward the night, the Sphinx, and the rising wind.
"You think that this isn't an emergency?"
Braun Lamia realizes that they are talking about the consul bringing his spacecraft here from the city of Keats. "Are you sure that the absence of alcohol isn't the emergency you're referring to?" she asks. Silenus glares at her.
"Would it hurt to have a drink?"
"No," says the consul. He rubs his eyes, and Lamia remembers that he too is addicted to alcohol. But his answer to bringing the ship here had been no. "We'll wait until we have to."
"What about the Fatline transmitter?" says Kassad.
The consul nods and removes the antique comm log from his small pack. The instrument had belonged to his grandmother, Siri, and to her grandparents before her. The consul touches the disk key. "I can broadcast with this, but not receive." Saul Weintraub has set his sleeping child in the opening of the closest tent. Now he turns toward the fire.
"And the last time you transmitted a message was when we arrived in the keep?"
"Yes." Martin Silenus's tone is sarcastic.
"And we're supposed to believe that, from a confessed traitor?"
"Yes." The consul's voice is a distillation of pure weariness. Kassad's thin face floats in the darkness. His body, legs, and arms are discernible only as a blackness against the already dark background.
"But it will serve to call the ship if we need it?"
"Yes." Father Hoyt hugs his cloak tighter around him to keep it from flapping in the rising wind. Sand scrapes against wool and tent fabric.
"Aren't you afraid that the port authorities or force will move the ship or tamper with it?" he asks the consul.
"No." The consul's head moves only slightly, as if he is too tired to shake it completely. "Our clearance pip was from Gladstone herself. Also, the Governor General is a friend of mine, was a friend." The others had met the recently promoted Hegemony governor shortly after landing. To Braun Lamia, Theo Lane had seemed a man catapulted into events too large for his talents.
"The wind's coming up," says Saul Weintraub. He turns his body to protect the baby from flying sand,
Still squinting into the gale, the scholar says,
I wonder if Hetmastine is out there.
We searched everywhere, says Father Hoyt.
His voice is muffled because he has lowered his head into the folds of his cloak.
Martin Silenus laughs. Pardon me, priest, he says, but you're full of shit.
The poet stands and walks to the edge of the firelight. The wind ruffles the fur of his coat and rips his words away into the night.
The cliff walls hold 1,000 hiding places. The crystal monolith hides its entrance to us, but to a Templar? And besides, you saw the stairway to the labyrinth in the deepest room of the Jade Tomb.
Hoyt looks up, squinting against the pinpricks of blowing sand.
You think he's there, in the labyrinth?
Silenus laughs and raises his arms. The silk of his loose blouse ripples and billows.
How the fuck should I know, Padre? All I know is that Hetmastine could be out there now watching us, waiting to come back to claim his luggage.
The poet gestures toward the Mobius cube in the center of their small pile of gear.
Or he could be dead already. Or worse.
Worse? Says Hoyt.
The priest's face has aged in the past few hours. His eyes are sunken mirrors of pain, his smile a rictus. Martin Silenus strides back to the dying fire.
Worse, he says. He could be twisting on the shrike's steel tree, where we'll be in a few...
Braun Lamia rises suddenly and grasps the poet by his shirt front. She lifts him off the ground, shakes him, lowers him until his face is on a level with hers.
Once more, she says softly, and I'll do very painful things to you. I won't kill you, but you will wish I had.
The poet shows his satyr's smile. Lamia drops him and turns her back. Kassad says,
We're tired. Everyone turn in. I'll stand watch.
My dreams of Lamia are mixed with Lamia's dreams. It is not unpleasant to share a woman's dreams, a woman's thoughts, even those of a woman separated from me by a gulf of time and culture far greater than any imagined gap of gender. In a strange and oddly mirror-like way, she dreamed of her dead lover, Johnny, of his too small nose and his too stubborn jaw, his too long hair curling over his collar, and his eyes, those too expressive, too revealing eyes that too freely animated a face which might, except for those eyes, belong to any one of 1,000 peasants born within a day's ride of London. The face she dreamed was mine. The voice she heard in that dream was mine. But the lovemaking she dreamed of, remembering now, was nothing that I had shared. I sought to escape her dream, if only to find my own. If I were to be a voyeur, it might as well be in the tumble of manufactured memories which passed for my own dreams. But I was not allowed to dream my own dreams. Not yet. I suspect that I was born, and born again from my deathbed, simply to dream those dreams of my dead and distant twin. I resigned myself, ceased my struggles to awaken, and dreamed. Braun Lamia comes awake swiftly, jarringly, shaken from a pleasant dream by some sound or movement. For a long second she is disoriented. It is dark, there is a noise, not mechanical, which is louder than most sounds in the Lussis hive where she lives. She is drunk with fatigue, but knows that she has awakened after very little sleep. She is alone in a small, confined space, in something resembling an oversized body bag. Raised on a world where enclosed places mean security from vicious air, winds, and animals, where many people suffer from agoraphobia when confronting the rare open space, but few know the meaning of claustrophobia, Braun Lamia nonetheless reacts as a claustrophobe. Clawing for air, pushing aside bedroll and tent flaps in a panicked rush to escape the small cocoon of fiber plastic, crawling, pulling herself along by her hands and forearms and elbows until there is sand under her palms and sky above. Not really sky, she realizes, suddenly seeing and remembering where she is. Sand. A blowing, raging, whirling sandstorm of particles, stinging her face like pinpricks. The campfire is out and covered with sand. Sand has banked on the windward side of all three of the tents, their sides flapping, cracking like rifle shots in the wind, and dunes of new-blown sand have grown up around the camp, leaving streaks and furrows and ridges in the lee of tents and gear. No one stirs from the other tents. The tent she was sharing with Father Hoyt is half-collapsed, all but buried by the rising dunes. Hoyt. It had been his absence which awakened her. Even in her dreams, some part of her consciousness had been aware of the soft breathing and almost indistinguishable moans from the sleeping priest as he wrestled with his pain. Sometime in the past half hour he had left, probably not more than a few minutes before. Braun Lamia knew that even as she had dreamed of Johnny, she had been half aware of a rustling, sliding sound above the rasp of sand and roar of the wind. Lamia gets to her feet and shields her eyes from the sandstorm. It is very dark, the stars are occluded by high cloud and the surface storm, but a faint, almost electrical radiance fills the air and reflects from rock and dune surface. Lamia realizes that it is electrical, that the air is filled with a static which makes the curls of her hair leap and writhe in Medusa-like gyrations. Static charges creep along her tunic sleeves and float over the tent surfaces like St. Elmo's fire. As her eyes adapt, Lamia realizes that the shifting dunes are aglow with pale fire. 40 meters to the east, the tomb called the Sphinx is a crackling, pulsing outline in the night. Waves of current move along the outflung appendages, often called the wings. Braun Lamia looks around, sees no sign of Father Hoyt, and considers calling for help. She realizes that her voice will not be heard above the wind roar. She wonders for a second whether the priest has merely gone to one of the other tents, or to the crude latrine 20 meters west. But something tells her that this is not the case. She looks at the Sphinx and, for the briefest second, seems to see the shape of a man, black cloak flapping like a falling pennant, shoulders hunched against the wind, outlined against the static glow of the tomb. A hand falls on her shoulder. Braun Lamia twists away, falls into a fighting crouch, left fist extended, right hand rigid. She recognizes Kassad standing there. The colonel is half again as tall as Lamia and half as broad, and miniature lightning plays across his thin form as he leans closer to shout in her ear.
He went that way.
The long black scarecrow arm extends toward the Sphinx. Lamia nods and shouts back, her voice almost inaudible to herself above the roar.
Shall we wake the others?
She had forgotten that Kassad was standing watch. Did the man never sleep? Fedmon Kassad shakes his head. His visors are up, and the helmet destructured to form a hood on the back of his combat-armored coverall. Kassad's face looks very pale in the glow from his suit. He gestures toward the Sphinx. His multipurpose force rifle is nestled in the crook of his left arm. Grenades, binocular case, and more mysterious items are draped from hooks and web belts on his impact armor. He points again toward the Sphinx. Lamia leans forward and shouts.
Did the Shrike take him?
Kassad shakes his head.
Can you see him?
She gestures toward his night visor and binoculars.
No,
says Kassad.
The storm fouls up heat signatures.
Braun Lamia turns her back to the wind, feeling the particles striking her neck like needles from a flechette gun. She queries her comlog, but it tells her only that Hoyt is alive and moving. Nothing else is being transmitted on the common band. She moves until she is next to Kassad, their backs forming a wall against the gale.
Are we going to follow him? She shouts.
Kassad shakes his head.
We can't leave the perimeter unguarded. I left telltales, but...
He gestures toward the storm. Braun Lamia ducks back in the tent, tugs on her boots, and emerges with her all-weather cape and her father's automatic pistol. A more conventional weapon, a gear stunner, is in the breast pocket of the cape.
I'll go then, she says.
At first she thinks that the colonel has not heard her, but then she sees something in his pale eyes and knows that he has. He taps the military comlog on his wrist. Lamia nods and makes sure that her own implant and comm log are set to the widest bandwidth.
"I'll be back," she says, and wades up the growing dune.
Her pant legs glow with static discharge, and the sand seems alive with silver-white pulses of current fleeting across its variegated surface. 20 meters from the camp, and she can see nothing of it. 10 meters farther, and the Sphinx rises above her. There is no sign of Father Hoyt. Footsteps do not survive 10 seconds in the storm. The wide entrance to the Sphinx is open, has been open as long as mankind has known of this place. Now it is a black rectangle in a faintly glowing wall. Logic suggested that Hoyt would have gone there, if only to get out of the storm. But something quite beyond logic tells her that this is not the priest's destination. Braun Lamia trudges past the Sphinx, rests in its lee for several moments to wipe the sand from her face and to breathe freely again, and then she moves on, following a faint, hard-packed trail between the dunes. Ahead of her, the jade tomb glows a milky green in the night, its smooth curves and crests oily with an ominous glow. Squinting, Lamia looks again, and sees someone or something outlined against that glow for the most fleeting of instants. Then the figure is gone, either inside the tomb or invisible against the black semicircle of its entrance. Lamia puts her head down and moves forward, the wind pushing and shoving at her as if hurrying her towards something important.